Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Ted Grosser, who will be speaking on Finding Christ Can't Be Your Primary Objective When Working with the Poor. So let's listen in on Ted Grosser.
In all of my almost 29 years of experience at this point, failure is a real element in almost every project. One of my talks was, whatever you think you're going to do, you're probably not going to do. And I'm talking from the point of view of not your one-on-one kind of a thing, but if you're setting up a project, for instance, we're working with about 10,000 children who are victims of Chernobyl and trying some experiments and so on that. And some of the things we thought we were going to do proved not to work. At one point, we were setting up a computer bank, and this was before the revolution, the last one, and the KGB in Minsk destroyed all the computers. So you have to take another tack sometimes, huh? I tell the story that I tell often of a project we had started in Honduras, where we were going to set up this model village. We had all the money for it to do everything. Everything from clinics to schools to roads to teaching the most basic kinds of cottage industry and so on, and helping them market it, and all the ladies wanted to do, by way of a first project, was fence off the cemetery and keep the cows and the goats and the whatever from going over their children's graves. And so the fact is that what you think you're going to do, you're not going to do, okay? You've got to give, you've got to, one of the big lessons or rules that we have in our staffing is that you have to listen. And you really have to listen, because what you're going after ultimately is local ownership, huh? Local leadership and local ownership. So that you train the leaders, you give them all the responsibility that you possibly can, and then you step back. And we have projects in 16 countries. We have no Americans on our staffs anyplace, except the United States, okay? And where we're working in Mississippi, we have an African-American who has grown up in Mississippi. In South Central Los Angeles, where we have a large program, we have an African-American woman who is real adept and skilled and experienced in community development and messing with the politicians and that whole business. Because if you think you can get away without listening, I could sit here and tell you stories from now until next week this time about people who went in and assumed they knew what was the answer, or that they really understood the problem. My favorite one is one that also comes out of Honduras. And when Senator Wong went down at one point, and he saw a water wheel that had little cups on it that went in and it dumped water into this log, and it went in and it irrigated farmland. And he just loved that thing. He went back to Washington, talked it up and so on. And 5 or 6 months later, we're coming back down through Honduras, and the U.S. Aid director in the country said, God, help us. Come and help us find. I said, what do you need? He said, I got to find 24 sites for water wheels. Because we've approved, we've got the money approved. The truth is, we couldn't find more than 5 in a whole camping country, you know, because it was tailored for that particular situation. Another thing I want to suggest to you that is important in listening and being committed to local leadership is that you understand that if you are not part of that community, and I mean really immediately part of it, you don't really know what's going on. If you're coming from the capital of any city, any third world country, and you are going probably more than about 20 miles, even closer in some cases, to a village, you are as much a foreigner in this village as if you were coming 10,000 miles away, okay? And I would suggest to you that the very same thing holds true in the United States. If I think I can go from where I live in suburban San Diego to our program in downtown San Diego and be one of the folks, you know, assuming you know I was the right coloration, okay? But if I think I can be one of the folks, I am wrong, okay? I really can't be. And that needs to be part of the reality of how I'm operating and what I'm doing, okay? Just the acknowledgement that you are kind of a foreigner, you're kind of a traveler through this thing. And what you can do is offer sometimes resources, sometimes technology, sometimes just simply motivation. My favorite story about motivation and really the importance of American motivation is a Peace Corps story in India where they took 30 of the untouchables and they trained them to be what we call barefoot doctors, that they were going to be primary health care workers who really were providing preventative medicine and were part, they were the front line, if you will, of a healthcare system that once it got beyond the preventative care and first aid, the person was referred on and on into a regional hospital. Anyway, they trained all of these guys and gave them their assignments, had a big ceremony, and the trainers left. And one of the trainers, who was a local Peace Corps worker in India, came back about 10 days later. And they're all there yet, stooped down, camping, just kind of hanging out. And after he went through his rage of, you know, trained you, we're paying you, what are you doing here? He said, man, you don't expect us to walk into our villages, do you? I mean, we're supposed to be important people. We're supposed to have prestige. If we don't get something more than this, man, nobody's going to pay attention to us. And the guy said, man, I don't know. Because they all wanted jeeps and drivers is what they wanted. He said, even if I get a couple of these, it's going to take weeks. What he did is he rounded up 36 Peace Corps workers to walk into the village with each one of these guys. And they had all the prestige that they needed to get started and get going. And I think, again, one of the things I want to talk about is this kind of a real a sensitivity, if you will, huh? And a sensitivity to local customs, to again, what these folks perceive their need as. We're going through a real interesting thing in South Central Los Angeles. We started out identifying about 70 different needs. So one of the guys who was the key organizer for us in South Central is, in fact, a real prominent, powerful Baptist minister, Dr. E.B. Hill. And his theory is there is money out there for every problem that ever beset the inner city. Okay? There is even a bureaucracy for every one of them, okay? And there's even an agenda and a great, wonderful mission statement. The problem is the people down here supposed to serve never know any of this stuff. And that if there is an agency around that, and this is his opinion, okay, that is working more than about 25% efficiency and really reaching, he says, that's a banner agency. And so one of the things we're trying to do at this point is organize at the grassroots level. We've identified about 70 groups that are interested in improving their school, improving a playground, better services to the aged, anti-drug programs or drug rehabilitation programs, just a whole array of things. And the 70 is a little bit misleading because some of these are duplicated. Okay, there's a neighborhood over here interested in the school or a group, and there's another one over here. And the target population is about 400,000 in South Central Los Angeles. Anyway, we're cranking this whole thing up, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, our project director calls me up and says, man, I'm making real progress on alleys. I said, what are you talking about, alleys? come on, Sheila, we're talking about schools and this and that. She said, no, I'm into alleys. And I said, what? How did this happen? Okay. The city of Los Angeles has approved the closing of about 1,000 alleys. A bunch of them in South Central Los Angeles. They're too narrow for regular traffic. They're not used for what they were originally proposed to use. They're used, in fact, as a spot for drug deals, dumping all manner of junk, people getting mugged and killed, and a whole bunch of other things. And in fact, it brought about a condition where people don't go out their back doors if their back door faces an alley. So this one alley happens to be near Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church, which is Hill's church, and Sheila happens to be a member, and she just thought it'd be a neat thing to, you know, close this alley, okay? I mean, it's not as easy as it sounds. I mean, they have to get all the owners to sign off, and she's gotten together with Cal State students to figure out whether the best use of this alley is community gardens, a playground for kids. And so they have about five different models. Anyway, we're in the last stages of closing this alley. She now has 71 different requests to help her close alleys. So we may be in an alley business for a while, okay? But it's no different to me, as I look at it, than the Honduran story with the mothers who wanted the cemetery fenced in and so on, okay? And so that's what we're going to do, okay? But at the same time, what we're also trying to do is something that's going to be, in the long term, much more difficult. Because the program we have there is called Bridges of Hope. And the bridges thing is my bright idea, okay? My perception is, after watching two major riots in Los Angeles, that the first one in Watts came, tore the place up, a whole lot of people scattered out to help, and then everybody went away. Okay, and truthfully, if you really want to look at what happened a couple years ago, you're looking really at the second act of a play that started 30 years ago or more. Okay, and that even the Rodney King thing was really kind of the match that was just kind of thrown in there, and boom. Okay, and I would hope that we can at this point do some things that work for some real permanent change. Okay. And that's one of the things that our organization specializes in overseas. We go in and we make a commitment for 10 years. And the reason is I don't think a 3-year or a 5-year grant do anything but stir the water up and away you go, okay? Because if you're looking for permanent change, you're looking to change people's attitudes and habits and culture, okay? I don't have any problem wanting to change people's culture. If people are getting killed or dying, where there's infant mortality, and I go to areas where it's 30, 40%. I've never talked in 20-some years, or over 20, almost 30 years, to a mother that said, oh no, our honored custom is we let babies die. Don't give my children a shot. Never heard that once, okay? They want that, okay? And the truth is, the Japanese have done such a wonderful marketing of transistor radios that you can go in the remotest parts of the world, up in the Andes and Asia and the most remote parts of the jungle, and people got transistor radios. And if they're even a little close to a city, they got television. I've gone in the most bizarre thing. You're coming into the darkest jungle and you're going through, and it's dark pitched. All of a sudden you see flashing lights and, you know, everybody's gathered around a couple of houses where they got the television on, okay? To think that we can somehow preserve some corners where modern civilization is going to reach isn't real, really isn't, okay? And that's going to cause, and is causing, some revolutions all over the world, okay? One of the theories is that the Chinese could not stop Tiananmen Square from becoming known around the world because of fax machines. It's not fast. The first time I met the Minister of Health in Belarus was before this last revolution, okay? And we hit it off and we were setting up a program because their concern really was with children who are victims of Chernobyl, and they're doing with what they can a whole lot. But we were going to keep in touch and so on, and we needed to set up kind of a way of keeping in touch that didn't run through the bureaucracy. And he said, never telephone me. Never do it. First of all, you can't. You didn't even have to tell you that. If you ever try to call, it's getting better, but if you ever try to call a former Soviet bloc country, it is a nightmare. And the reason is that they had less international lines going into the whole of the Soviet Union than we have in San Diego, California. Okay? And they all went through one place where the KGB could go check it out. Okay? Anyway, he said, always send a fax. I said, okay, well, that's fine. And I said, why? He says, it's too fast. The KGB can't do anything with it. It just can't. And if you know, the fax is 1 minute, it's gone. And their system was such that a call could start and they really couldn't get into it until it was about 3 minutes, 2.5 to 3 minutes. So your fax was in and your communication was safe, okay? The modern stuff that we're talking about is all over the place and people know about it. And we need to be there to give it, but we need to be real sensitive. I grew up in a tough neighborhood where a bunch of kids I was in Boy Scouts with all ended up in jail. I was very lucky, and a couple of others didn't, okay? And one of the things they taught me was how to open a safe, okay? And how to feel the tumblers.
They taught you this in Boy Scouts?
This was a very advanced... I grew up in a real poor neighborhood.
The Eagle Scouts, right?
The Eagle Scouts. It might have been after Scouts. I don't remember.
The Scouts were...
What they did, though, is they would take sandpaper, and they literally sandpapered the end of their fingers so that the skin was almost paper thin. You could almost... And I can remember, this is more than a couple weeks ago, my buddies, you know, that you could see the blood kind of pulsing through. And they could take that sucker and they could just go boop, feel it fall, go back and forth. So I never did, because if I did that to my fingers, my mother would probably brain me. You know, so I was dissuaded from doing that. But it does work. And it does become, for me, a real reminder of what we have to be and what we have to do as we are trying to help other people. We need to be as sensitive as we possibly can to where they're at and what their needs are. And we're not always. I worked very hard in 1976 after the earthquake in Guatemala to coordinate major pieces of the medical relief after the earthquake that was there. And the earthquake that was there was more terrible than anything we've ever had in the United States. It kind of went, this is the country, it kind of went kitty corner, split the thing apart with an 8.4 earthquake. Thousands and thousands of people living in adobe huts had them sheared off and big tile roofs came down. And almost 10% of the population died. And another equal amount also were maimed or injured and so on. The thing that I learned there is a whole lot of junk, a whole lot of needless stuff is sent by very well-meaning people, okay? And some by steamers. In 1972, there'd been a big earthquake in Managua, Nicaragua, and it was really one of the bigger ones in the 70s anyway, where people were very, very generous and sent all kinds of things. And Somoza sorted through, kept all the good stuff, and warehoused all the junk, okay? 1974, there was a horrible hurricane in Honduras, which was right next door, okay? Somoza was the first one there delivering all the junk he didn't want, okay? And the Honduran government, wanting to be helpful in the future, warehouse this stuff, and when the earthquake came in 76, shipped it to Guatemala, okay? Along with a whole lot of other stuff, okay? And one of the sad jobs I had was saying, yeah, let's dump this, and let's not warehouse it, ship it someplace else. We dug big trenches and just buried this stuff, okay? So that just good intentions aren't enough, okay? And the story I tell, which is sad but funny, okay, is that the average Mayan Indian, which is the majority of the population in Guatemala, if they get to be 5 feet, they're tall. Okay, we have lots of broken legs and so on. We get this whole big truckload of metal rods that are put in orthopedic. Okay? They're all for 6 foot tall or more people. Okay, and these rods have to be coated so that they don't contaminate the body and so on and deteriorate. So there wasn't any way of cutting these things. But then we had this hole where we had about a ton of this stuff. Absolutely worthless. We had physicians fly in the day or two after the earthquake, leave their plane on the runway to stop the other big relief plane from landing, because they would roar off because they were going to dramatically help. And they took the Captain Pick and Key with them, and we were almost lifting airplanes off the runway. And I must tell you that that wasn't a unique experience, okay? It happens every single time there is a big disaster someplace in the world. And I'm not knocking the people, okay? I really am not. I'm just saying that there is a certain sense in which if we don't engage our head and our sensitivities and our understanding of really what's going on, we're not going to be very helpful. And very often, we're going to start out with the best of all possible motives and the best of all possible plans and find out, like here, it fails because we're off in the wrong direction, or it's just not going to work for any number of reasons. And one of the things that I have been trying to focus on this week is that I really think there is a spiritual side to working with the poor wherever they are in the world. And I want to share that with you, because I think where this title came from is, on the one hand, I believe with all of my heart that as you reach out to help others, God reveals himself to you. And Christ is there in a way that gives you a very, very special blessing. And I think, I'm not going to give you a whole bunch of proof texts, but when Jesus said, what you do to the least of these, you do to me, we need to take that seriously. And we need to see in the poor of the world a situation that is going to be very different from our view, which is we need them more than they need us. Okay? We need them so that we have an opportunity to really demonstrate that God's love is really in us. And they need to accept it, and accepting is sometimes almost tougher than giving, okay? If you don't think about that, think about how much easier it is for me to give you something than it is for me to take it from you, okay? Because when I take it, I'm indebted, you know, or feel you kind of put me down, or think that you're going to help me. Okay? We spent a whole lot of time, my wife and I, working in Latin America. And in Latin America, they have the great patron system. One wealthy person who's very powerful, who doles out all of the help. And all the rest of the campesinos or the poor farmers come and get their help, okay? Unless they've displeased the patron, and then they can be punished. And that's part of the culture, and that's the way that works, okay? The thing that I want to suggest to you, though, is that there has to be in all of this stuff, not only sensitivity, but there needs to be respect for the people you help, okay? And it can't be, gee whiz, you poor dumb peasant, or you poor dumb kid in the slums, or whatever, okay? Whether it's an immigrant or whatever, because we've got, in California, we have big-time refugee problems of illegals, okay? But if we don't find ways of respecting them, nothing's going to work. And if Christians do not and cannot find the way to respect the people they minister to, there is something radically wrong with their understanding of the gospel. Okay? Because A, if in fact you were looking at a 75 to 90% probability of failure, you better know what it is to be forgiven. Hmm? you better know that forgiveness is not something that you just do on Sunday morning. It's part and parcel of what you do and how you live and how you, and for somebody like me, how I work. Because I approve a whole lot of stuff that doesn't work. And when something that I approve doesn't work, people die. Okay? And if I don't remember that God forgives me and God accepts me not as I'd like to be, but as I am, not as I'd like to present myself to you as this great, wonderful person, huh? But as the guy who is trying to balance budgets and figure out how to fudge here and fudge there so that that can happen. Okay? And sometimes it isn't done in time. And it blows up. And forgiveness for me is a very real ingredient every single day of my life. And so, and as forgiveness is, so is new life, huh? Or new beginnings, or a new chance. And for me, I don't know how anybody can get into this stuff and do this real seriously if this isn't a very real part of what they're doing, okay? And then all of these other things begin to fall into place, okay? Because down here, if I really am honest about who I am, okay, and understand that God's grace covers that, huh? And that grace isn't something I earned, it's something I was given, okay? God doesn't love me because I'm a good guy. God just loves me because I am. And as I have this gift of grace, it is going to reflect down here, okay? And I then am able to love and respect and forgive and understand. Doesn't mean I need to approve. When I have some meetings with gangs, or there was a point, this is what, 79, there was a polio epidemic in Nicaragua, and we were, interestingly enough, able to work out an agreement in which Somoza side and the Sandinista side had a stand down for 4 days, and we immunized all the kids. And then the beggars picked up and started killing all the adults off, but we at least helped the kids. But we were able to say, hey, we really want to do this. This has to be done. And you do it in a way that gets it done, okay? I'm going to stop now. Comments. I don't know if any of this is good, bad, or indifferent news to you. The whole figure thing is one I could go on and on. I every place I've gone, and in the United States and around the world, lots of good stuff, lots of people trying to do things, it just doesn't work.
Do you ever have any experience of planning in advance
for
people that are
serving? Oh, sure. Well, I don't know about your experience, but God doesn't listen to my plans very well. You know? I try to be real explicit in my writing, write him out, I pray about him. And he always seems to have a different agenda. Or for however you want to talk about.
For example, after sort of working with the people that want, what they really wanted was to fence around the cemetery. It seems like if before deciding what the projects were going to be in that place, people spent time planning in advance with the people who live in that place.
Okay, but
maybe the plan would be a little bit closer to
that. That couldn't have happened, though. No, that could not have happened until that fence was up, the supplies were there, the fence was up, the grass was cut, and it was all done. And then began something that is absolutely essential for any kind of planning at all. Okay?
Oh yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you about cemetery fencing. I'm just trying to say that, and maybe just isn't realistic for the work that you do, but sometimes it is really possible in planning a project to spend time talking to the people before.
Oh, and we do. You have to have all kinds of plans, and you have to have evaluations, and oh yeah, that's really part of it. The problem is that we really understand very imperfectly what the situation, what the conditions are. And in the end, it's been my experience that facts have very little meaning. That what you really need to do is deal with perceptions and how a person perceives of X, Y, or Z. We see this in this country. The news media can build up a frenzy over this, that, or the other thing that has nothing to do with...